I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Serve Remember Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Serve Remember Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, everyone. It's Raghu, and I'm back with Robert Thurman. And I have to say, with Robert, it's a love affair that got initiated by our very, very close mutual friend, Krishna Dass. You won't remember this, Bob. We first met at a His Holiness Dalai Lama event. In New York, I believe, many, many, many moons ago.
I think I knew, at the Beacon Theater.
Yeah, we were sitting in those tables.
Yeah, I remember that.
Oh, I remember that.
I remember seeing you there. You know?
Yeah, so...
I think you've trimmed your beard since then.
Yeah, maybe a little bit. so happy to have you here, Bob. And one of the things that I mentioned to Bob... before doing this podcast was since we have not really communicated at all since Ram Dass left at the end of last year. And one of the things I wanted was to get, Bob has known Ram Dass well before most of us when he was Richard Alpert. And I just want to get some, a little bit of the story of your meeting him and how he came into your life and the how that evolved all the way to these retreats in the last few years that you did in Maui. And can we do that? This will be such a thrill for me.
Yeah, well, when I was undergrad at Harvard, I read Aldous Huxley. Actually, Aldous Huxley came to a theater performance I did where I played Troilus in Troilus and Cressida.
I didn't know you were an actor then, too.
I was then. I had aspiration to do that and intention, and actually more to be a playwright than actor, but I did act in that one performance. And at the inauguration of the Loeb Theater on Brattle Street in Cambridge, a Harvard thing. And Aldous Huxley was there at the opening of Old Troilus and Cressida, and there's a terrible speech at the end of that where Troilus laments the fall of Troy and his loss of Cressida, and Huxley wept, apparently, in my delivery.
Oh, really?
And he came backstage to tell me that, and he was really nice. It was my one meeting with him. And then I was reading Henri Michaux in French about mescaline, so I discovered the psychedelic world. The non-conceptual understandings that you're thrown into having to kind of deal with experiences through it with with psychedelics, and naturally then was interested in Richard and Tim and Ralph, the triumvirate that was working at Harvard at that time. Although I didn't get any stuff from him. He, you know, they were blamed as if they had turned on some undergraduates, but it was circulating already
in
the undergraduate body, and it wasn't really there. They didn't really. They had some experiments with some people, I think. Very small doses. Actually, we considered them somewhat square, actually.
Really?
Yes. Because they were into, like, you know, set and setting and moderate and observation and small doses. They were being very responsible, you know, psychologists doing their research. And we were taking big doses of different things and riding motorcycles and listening to Joan Baez singing at the Cafe Mount Auburn. On Auburn Street, behind this sort of off a block away from Mass Ave, you know, sort of, we had a whole scene. There was a whole scene, and I was already married to my first wife at that time, and I was a young madman. And then in the middle of that, you know, I lost an eye, which was really lucky, because I could have lost my life. I was a bit wild driving and motorcycling and so on, and. So a garage accident, lost the eye clumsily doing something in a garage. And then that made me want to drop out of Columbia. That was a big impermanence visionary experience in itself. And when I came out of that, I wanted to leave Harvard. And I didn't actually necessarily want to leave that marriage, but my ex didn't want to go with me to India. I was going to, Hermann Hesse in hand, Gurdjieff in hand, Edward Conso's Prajna Paramita in hand, etc. I was off for India gradually. It took a while. That was 61, fall of 61. And then I, the process of doing that, I stopped by the Tim and their building. They were living in North Cambridge, I think, at that point. They hadn't gone to Newton yet. So I kind of got to know them, introduced myself to them. And there I was like one of their sort of people on the fringes of their thing. And they were kind of surprised that we were riding motorcycles while stoned. But we had a great time. It was a few other people, I know. And
what was Ram Dass like then?
Well, he was wonderful. He was, you know, he was a snappy Harvard professor. I believe he had a green Mercedes convertible that was, you know, it wasn't souped up, but it was a nice green. He used to ride around that, and he was very trim, you know, and cheerful, and very, of course, brilliant. And, you know, I think he had tenure or something. I believe he did at Harvard. And Tim did not. Tim was like a visiting prof, and Metzner was maybe a fellow. He wasn't really on the faculty there, I think, at that time. And they were doing, you know, they hadn't yet gotten more far out. So anyway, then I went off to India. So then I didn't see him for over a year. And when I came back at the end of 62, I then stopped by their Newton thing, their thing in Newton. And I may have had a trip or two. I tripped a little bit on that pilgrimage to India. But then fairly soon after that, I met Geshe Wangyal instead of going back to India. And then I started studying in New Jersey.
Right, your teacher.
And Richard, as you remember, he wrote about Geshe Wangyal. He was almost the first big Eastern person that he met. And he came down to see me there, and he brought another fellow student of mine from Harvard who had been more involved with them while I was away, and who had his issues. He had issues before he was involved with them and after. And then he thought he would, maybe the Mongolian Lama could help him, and he did somewhat help him. A man named Foster Dunlap, who was a marvelously brilliant person and so on. And that's another whole story. But anyway, that brought Richard down to the monastery, and he met the Geshe. And he drove him around a little bit. And I believe he was driving him in his green Mercedes when they ran out of gas in the East Side Drive. He was taking him somewhere, which is an incident he repeats in the Be Here Now, as I recall. But somehow he didn't really study that much with Geshe Law, but he realized there was something special there, you know, from the East. You know, he didn't know what at that point, right?
So this is before Richard went to India first time.
Yeah, before he went, right. Yeah. But he was still in Millbrook at that time, you know. And then, you know, various all kinds of things happened. And then Tim came back with my future bride, who was his ex-bride at that point, or about to be his ex-bride, Nina. And then and they had some things happened in Millbrook. And then eventually Richard decided to leave Millbrook. And then Richard went to India. And then he became no longer Richard. Very eventually he became Ramdas, right? Which was really great. And I met him once then when I was a graduate student in India. I didn't see him during my whole graduate time when I came back from. And I didn't take any acid at all during the whole time I was a monk and with the Dalai Lama and with Geshe Wangyal, because I was learning to a little bit do that with meditation, like Richard did later. And in fact, I was so into that, that at a certain point, long after Ramdas was, I think while he was in India, at one point when I decided to leave the monastery, because I realized that, I don't want to talk too much about me, but I decided to leave the monastery. And then I thought, well, I'm going to go, first of all, see my old friends at Millbrook, because they're in trouble now with, you know, Tim having been busted in Texas and all this kind of taking on the government, you know, and with a trial hanging over him for pot, you know, and so on. And I said, I'm going to go get them to cool down, learn to meditate, stop taking so much illegal and try to get them to see there's a safer and legal, more legal way at the moment. And so I went up there, and then Tim was happy to invite me there. But then things escalated. And at a certain point, I realized they wouldn't really listen to me, because they basically figured the reason I was a monk, even, or had been a monk, was that I'd had a bad trip or something. And, you know, because they were so convinced that being stoned was the doorway to enlightenment. So then just to show them, I said, well, okay, you know, turn me on and see what happens. And they did, and it was pretty far out, actually, with the kind of high-dose Millbrook dose that they used in those days.
Yeah.
And with what I had studied for 3 or 4 years as a Tibetan monk, it was much more far out than earlier trips that I had.
I bet.
And then they still, of course, wouldn't listen to me, and I stopped worrying about it that much. And I didn't quite know then what to do, but luckily, somewhere around that time, I met Nina, and then I decided I would, you know, then a whole thing later happened with me where I went back to school and everything. And then I didn't see again Ramdas for some time, but he stopped by when he was beginning his sort of mission around the States to see me once, when he was actually fairly fresh back from Maharaji, and long hair, and white, still wearing white dhotis and white long Indian things, big beard, and very like eyes, you know, like shining. And he came to visit us, and my kids were kind of worried. they didn't know what he was, you know. They were like, oh, and he. Because he was kind of flipped out, so he rushed over to hug them. If he hadn't approached them, it would have been okay, because they'd been in India. They were only 3 or 4 years old, but especially the older one, the boy got it, and he was like, oh, when he went over to give him a big hug. So then Ramdas was kind of a little freaked by that. Oh no, you know, didn't react to my total love. He hadn't yet, I think, had enough experience being a guru a little bit to realize that you have to kind of approach people a little more carefully. Because he himself was so flipped out with the joy of having discovered Maharaji and beginning to dig deeper than he had. And of course, people mustn't forget, of course, about Saint Ramdas, that he, when before that, he was a psychonaut, you know, Stan Grof and my term, a voyager in the mind, through serious psychedelics. And he'd really been heaven and hell, you know, which I think opened him, as it did for so many, to then receiving the darshan and the blessings of Neem Karoli Baba. If he had been a straight, square psychologist when he met Neem Karoli, just a regular psychologist, I don't think it would have been the same outcome, actually.
And he says the same thing over and over.
Well, for years, he kind of kept it under wraps, which was wise, because, you know, the square of society was out to arrest everybody for everything, you know, like they've been doing, like they're trying to reassert themselves to do now, right? Mm-hmm. They're like arresting Black Lives Matter, the peaceful people.
Yeah.
And the most awful thing, but I don't know if you know that, but you know, those stormtroopers that Gestapo that Bill Barr sent to Portland and Seattle, mm-hmm. and this,
yep,
that,
yep.
Do you know who they are? They are not just, there's a few mixed in Homeland Security and alcohol and tobacco and firearms people like that, executive branch sort of MPs. But the harsh ones are contractors hired from Eric Prince's private Blackwater Army.
Oh, I did not know that. Oh,
and they God. Are therefore beholden to nobody. And that's the brother, if people don't know that, of DeVos, you know, Betsy DeVos, the horrible,
education,
so-called miseducation,
yeah.
indoctrination minister, let's say. And so that's very dire. When they eventually unelected, and when that comes out, that will be a major scandal. Imagine that. You dare to hire such people yeah. who are perfectly great mercenary soldiers, but they're not really into dealing with peaceful protesters.
Yeah, to say the least. All right, well, we're going to talk more about that a little later.
Okay, all right. So that's it. So then I was, I saw all of Ram Dass's deeds and books and really loved what he did for so many people. And, Mickey Lemley, who made those movies about him, you know, then made movies about Dalai Lama. So yeah. sort of I knew that. And whenever I could find Ram Dass, I did. And actually, when he came back, one of the things that in that same time, actually, is when I fell in love again, or even more than when I originally knew him, when he said this wonderful thing, I thought, at a speech at Smith College during that time, he visited us as a family. And he said, he recounted how in the Bangladesh wartime, where I had met him, actually, and Krishna Das and Adan Goldman and Surya Das. No, Surya Das was not with them, but a bunch of them
yeah.
who had been in Kausani doing a retreat. And I was living in Almora at that time as a grad student. And I also saw him when he was with Muktananda yeah. in Pune, where he had a terrible headache because he wasn't so compatible with Muktananda. Ultimately, at first, he was intrigued by him, but
yeah.
It wasn't Neem Karoli. You know, Neem Karoli sent him off there because he was all into Kundalini. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
But power, Kundalini, power, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Kundalini gave him a headache. So luckily he went back to Bhakti. You know? But I saw him when he had that headache.
Yo.
And with Muktananda. And I was not that excited about Muktananda myself. But, I stayed out of his way, on the other hand. He was quite a forceful character. Mm-hmm. And so I had met him then, but then in this speech, which he was given, he recounted how he was so upset by the genocide of the Bengalis going on by the West Pakistanis in Bangladesh that he said to Maharaji, he said, "Oh, that's horrible, terrible. I want to go." And Krishna Das tells the story about he wanted to use his Volkswagen as an ambulance and go there. Probably would have perished if he had. But anyway, he had a good impulse to do that. And then in addition to discouraging him to do that, which was very practical and probably saved his life, Maharaja also said, "But don't you see, it's so perfect." In other words, you know, don't get upset even by seemingly horrible, surface horrible things. And then Ram Dass said back, "Well, okay, Guruji, it's perfect, but it stinks."
Yeah, right, yeah.
And I loved that. Mm. And it really reminded me, I was at the very time in Almora still, and I was very upset about what was going on there. I had various visions and fierce deities, all kinds of things, trying to stop it. And then I had a dream where my old Mongolian guru, he was still alive at that time, but anyway, where he appeared to me in the dream sitting on a stone bench in the yard in front of these Himalayan mountains where I was staying in retreat in Almora. And I was angrily shouting at him, same way. And I was saying, "Where's that Nirmanakaya, all the emanation bodies of the Buddha? How come he isn't emanating some UN troops or some neutral people or some whatever, you know? to stop this killing babies and this horrible thing that's going on there. What's wrong with it? Where is that Nirmanakaya of yours, sort of thing? I was challenging the vision of the sort of esoteric, slightly esoteric vision, or used to be more esoteric vision, of the good guys really being in charge, actually, of the world and seeing to it that this kind of atrocities don't go on. And or at least that's how I thought it was. And so I was like saying, it stinks, you know, where is it? And he didn't say anything. He didn't answer me. He didn't say, don't you see it's perfect like Maharaji did. But what he did, what he did in the dream was his image became bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And finally, I was like screaming like a little mosquito at his knee level. And he was bigger than all those 27,000 foot snow-capped mountains for which you see from Almora, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, Trishul and Nanda Devi, you know, the biggest mountains in Himalayan mountains in India. And he, in other words, like, the picture is bigger than you know, sort of routine, you know what I mean?
Yeah, you know.
And,
yeah.
And so I really identified with Ram Dass, yes, agreeing with his guru that there must be a level on which, you know, love, Krishna, and that idea would be Krishna, Rama, you know, Vishnu. He's taking care of even the ones who are dying. He's going to take care of them. Even it seems terrible what happened to them in this life, he's going to follow them through in other lives and make it okay, you know, and work with it. But this is temporarily, can't be stopped at the moment.
Yeah.
And the bad guys who are doing the killing, their negative karmas, somehow that will also be taken care of over it and so on. So I, you know, great, but it stinks anyway for the moment. Like, you know, I'm not going to just sort of be complacent about it.
Yeah, yeah. I fell
in love with him. I felt whoever his teacher was, Ram Dass, he was the right person. Mm. And Ram Dass himself was keeping his right Buddha nature, you could say, Bodhisattva nature, you know, Buddha nature. And so I just said, this is great. And, you know, more power to him.
So we used to, in Maui at the retreats, Ram Dass would tell that story.
Uh-huh.
And then we had little conversations, he and I. And I would say, I believe there needs to be an addendum to the story. It stinks, okay? And the addendum is, Neem Karoli Baba can say that, operating out of non-duality, and say the big picture, but we can't say that because people react and go, oh, yeah, we're just supposed to sit on our ass meditating and not take any action, any action regarding any of these issues. And right now, of course, the issues around social justice, et cetera. And so he then started speaking to that, so everybody would get a better picture of
what did he say? What did he say?
He just said, from limited point of view, which is where I am coming from, because I am not living in non-duality as Neem Karoli Baba was. From that point of view, I have to always understand that I need that. Intellectually, I understand it's all perfect, but I am not living that 100%. But I'm working on that on a day-to-day basis, while at the same time, I'm taking whatever actions seem appropriate to change the world in whichever small way that I can do it. Not exactly in those words, but something like that.
Yes.
And
yes,
so that started a conversation that enabled people to get a little bit more of an understanding of what Maharaji was really saying, which you just elucidated a little bit. It's everything gets embraced and transformed, and we cannot understand that.
Yes. And the point is, if we get too fixated on the evil that's going down, we might become where our activism will be based on rage and anger and hatred of the evildoers. And then we're just adding to it, and we will not improve the situation.
Yeah, exactly. And exactly so what Ram Dass would say.
So we have to, even if we're not yet knowing that we are all actually have always been living non-duality, because the non-duality is non-duality, and it's right here and now, actually, even it supports duality, actually, and it embraces it, and it sees to the that the good guys are stronger, actually, and will do win. And then Shambhala comes, and everything is good. But we can simulate it to the extent of, you know, we shouldn't act out of rage or anger or hatred. And, you know, these nonviolent, you know, it's very obviously, you know, Barr and Trump, crazy people on the far right who are doubling down on making it even worse for themselves in the long run. They are trying to pretend that these peaceful justice protesters are violent.
Yeah.
And they're trying to frame them, actually. And I just read today that it was revealed, there's media, you can find it. It was revealed that the guy in the first protest in Minneapolis who started smashing windows was a white supremacist guy carrying an umbrella and started smashing windows dressed in black.
I saw that, yeah.
To try to pretend he was one of them. So that's the agent provocateur strategy that the oppressor will use to try to take away the moral high ground from the nonviolent protester, because actually the nonviolent one is more powerful because it appeals to human beings' hearts. And human being, even the bad guys, ultimately are actually even gentle. You know? The gentleness is in the heart of even the worst bad guy. You know, if I read Mary Trump's book word for word.
Oh, yeah.
And that poor man, who is now a definite evildoer in his behavior, but he's a little shriveled up little 3-year-old who just frightened of the world trying to bully his way out of his fear. And he's a miserable wretch in there, you know, like, and so he really is a worthy.
He actually said last night, nobody likes me.
Yeah, that's it. That's the 3-year-old.
Yeah, 3-year-old is crazy.
And, you know, you get the detail because she's a psychologist. And she knows the drama of the broken mother and the quite vicious, a little bit, you know, Nazi. You know, his father was a card-carrying member of Nazi Party here in the U.S. And a Nazi-like grandfather who kept rebuffing these children whose mother was broken at 2.5 years old. And the older sister was not really capable of embracing them.
Yeah.
And it was really terrible. Yeah. I mean, it's a family story. It's truly terrible.
So back to Ram Dass Smith College, and you fell in love with him again. And then move along from there.
Yeah, sure. Well, there's nothing much to move then. Then I'm – because my life – from that time, there's a little bliss bubble with Nina and the children at the Dalai Lama. But then I was having to make my way as a young professor in a world that doesn't really teach the Dharma in the college.
No.
And yet I had to kind of do that. I couldn't not do that on the other hand, but I did it in actually an interesting way that you have to do in academia where you don't proselytize. And actually, I really don't. And luckily, Dalai Lama doesn't. He said the other day in the David Bohm movie, which I loved, and he always says that, but he said it in a very, very good way, you know, very, very straight-on way. You can't miss it, not just a hint. He said, in all my life, I have never taught Buddhism to people in general with a wish or an intention to make them Buddhists.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he believes that this new age that we have already, we are already in, is such that people should share the jewels and the treasures of their traditions with others who are not natural members of that tradition, only with the view of them helping them find the same treasures in their own tradition.
Yeah.
And not with some denominational conversion competition. Mm. And he has implored the Christians and the Muslims and the Hindus and promised from the Buddhist side that, and some of them have agreed with that, but unfortunately some are into converting other people.
Yeah, right. By the way, you mentioned a movie, Bob, that you went over quickly, the David...
There's a wonderful film that is still viewable online, I think, because they had to premiere it all online. And it's still viewable in some way called Infinite Potential.
Which
is about the wonderful physicist called David Bohm.
How do you spell his last name?
B-O-H-M.
Okay.
Who was the prize pupil of Oppenheimer.
Uh-huh.
You know, the A-bomb guy at Berkeley, and got his PhD and all that. But once his interpretation of the quantum world was that it leaves a room for mind and spirit, then Oppenheim and these people purposely blackballed him, and they didn't even argue with him because his arguments, mathematics and physicists' arguments, were irrefutable, that the real quantum formulas and everything proves that the observer's mind is a physical force, if super subtle, and therefore you can't be a physicist without dealing with the mind. And they couldn't answer that in physicist terms except by dogma, so they just ignored him. Anyway, that great movie was made about him, and he was a friend of both Krishnamurti, J. Krishnamurti, and the Dalai Lama, and therefore the Dalai and Krishnamurti has passed, that Krishnamurti has passed. So they showed some archival thing of his dialogues with Krishnamurti, and they showed some, and then they had the live Dalai Lama make some comments about his friend, David Bohm, who actually I also had some dinners with David, Mr. and Mrs. Bohm, and His Holiness, and attended on some of their conversation, which were really fun and really great, actually.
Yeah, and we'll link all this up, by the way, everybody. You'll get a chance in the show notes on my rolling on the Be Here Now network. Okay, so now we're gonna jump to when I started talking to you and saying, Bob, somehow you got to come out to Maui. Ram Dass would love to see you. And you were like, God, that would be so great. We got to make it happen. So a few years ago, we did make it happen. And you came out a couple of times. And so you had not seen Ram Dass in a very long time when you first came to Maui.
No, not for quite a while. That's right. And it wasn't just me also. It was Nina. And Nina had quite a different... Or in, she had an interim thing when she was at Millbrook and so forth with Ram Dass, and she knew him in a different way, and he knew her in a different way, and a little bit. And it was wonderful that they had that meeting as well. I think he enjoyed it, and she enjoyed it very, very much. And we became Ram Dass groupies too, like you guys. Krishna Dass was also a big part of it because.
Yeah.
You know, I do feel he's kind of, you know, he really carries Maharaji in his heart in a special way too, as do you, you know. So you became a part of it, you know. And it's, I kind of felt like I met Maharaji because, you know, I don't feel personally, the way I understand non-duality, I don't feel that these people leave, actually. They just leave a body when it's no longer a suitable instrument as far as they're concerned. But they remain around. And they can incarnate in other bodies if they wish, or they can just stay in a field form that other people can't necessarily right away perceive as a body, but they can contact them spiritually at any time. You know, there's a great Indian master of philosophy, you know, non-dual philosophy, and also Tantra, because Tantra and non-duality are always completely inextricably entwined. Mm. And because Tantra is a complete expression of non-duality. Chandrakirti was his name.
Chandrakirti, right.
He's known to have lived because of writings and recordings and his abbacies of different important monasteries in the 7th century. Although all the Indian dating is a little vague, you know, in the Buddhist history. But he claimed... in his own writing, that he received tantric initiation from Nagarjuna, who's known through writings to have lived around 2nd, 1st century. And although the Buddhists say he lived 600 years, actually, and they all of them say that. And Westerners won't believe it, you know. But it doesn't matter whether he was in the physical body or not, I'm sure. He initiated Chandrakirti in the 7th century without fail. And he could initiate me if I was as pure as Chandrakirti, if I had pure vision. Still, I'm sure Nagarjuna could, or Chandrakirti could. Because as people reach a certain level where they're completely conscious, not only of ultimate reality as if it was something apart from, fundamental to, but apart from the relational illusory reality, but because it is what illusory reality is made of, actually. And so they can manifest whatsoever they think is useful to whomsoever needs that. And I consider Maharaji like Larry says about
Larry Brilliant. Yeah,
Larry Brilliant says about come up a saying about Neem Karoli Baba. That it's a Buddha, just a Buddha. Don't give me something about some Swami.
Bodhisattva,
Buddha. He said Buddha.
He said Buddha.
And I believe that myself. I feel that way too. And totally, you know. Nirmana Kaya, what I was angry with Geshe Wangyal about with my guru, you know, my first guru, you know, about the Nirmana Kaya, because it wasn't stopping Bangladesh, you know, at that time. You know, Nirmana Kaya is inconceivable and miraculous for sure. No question in my mind nowadays.
You know, I don't know if Krishnadas ever told you this story. I'm sure you've heard it because you've done so many workshops together.
And no,
I know
tell.
But he and I, he had a bad knee, and I helped him get over to the ashram. It was just me and him and Maharaji and a translator, and he walked around with a limp, and he looked back at Krishnadas, and he smiled, and he came back and sat down and said, "How are you doing now? Okay?" You know, and Krishnadas, of course, all the pain left and all of that. But the story is Krishnadas had a diary there, and he had written some stuff from the Mahamudra, and Maharaji asked it to be translated.
Oh, yes.
And he said, "Teek, yes, indeed. Yeah, this is right on." And then he flipped the page, and there was a picture of him. And he said to us, "So who's that?" And we were like, "Well, you know, yeah, you're very, it's a joke, it's you." And he goes, "Nay, Buddha." And you know, the integration of many, many of us, from the friends that you know, Danny Goldman and Krishnadas, and many, many of us have taken teachings from Tibetans in particular over these many years. In fact, they're the ones, you know, he was instrumental in me meeting Kalu Rinpoche while I was with him, Maharaji, in India.
Sure.
Yeah. So that combination is very much of who we are as well. So it's a very, very interesting, which is why we have, you know, you guys are family to us, you know. It's an amazing thing. So now,
Igualmente, as they say.
Yes.
Igualmente.
Yeah. And I'll tell you one thing, though. You know, before we got on, I said, "Yeah, we'll talk about Ram Dass a little bit." And you said, "Yeah, the first Jewish saint. Isn't that incredible?" And I tell you, Ram Dass would be turning over now going,
"No, I didn't say Jewish. I said Hindu,
right. Hindu.
We have Jubus, and then we have Hindus, you know.
Yeah,
remember, and you remember how Ram Dass was upset because all his friends are Buddhists,
yeah,
and Hindu, and he wants to have a soul,
yeah,
and his other Buddhist friend said, "You're not allowed to have a soul. You can't have a soul." But the Dalai Lama thinks you can have a soul, and I think so.
And, how does the Dalai Lama put that? That's not something I'm aware of.
Oh, definitely. Actually, I don't mean to claim anything except maybe just I'm some kind of cipher or cosmic sponge or brainwashed. But I reached a point a few years ago, maybe 8-10 years ago, in teaching and around, that I was tired of this thing of no soul, translating anatma as soullessness. And really where it's really is selflessness, you know. And so then I realized that in order to explain in the Tantrayana, but it's still there. It's even there in the Theravada, which is a dualistic form of Buddhism. It's still there in what they call Chitta Santana. They don't use the word indestructible bindu, akshara bindu, which is the word they use in Tantra. But they use the word Chitta Santana, continuum of mind or spirit. And because they have to have something subtle that carries an individual person, while as long as they still erroneously think that they're ultimately only an individual, rather than relatively an individual and ultimately one with everything. But as long as they don't know that oneness with everything, they relatively go. And then that, there's a subtle form of that goes from death to rebirth, which is not the core sensory brain form with the sensory memories of the sensory experiences of our waking time, but rather the imprint in the super subtle, like almost like I consider it like a spiritual DNA, mental DNA. But it's not non-physical. It's not disconnected with the super subtle physical, like sub-quantum energy flow that's there without atoms. You know, super subtle, you know, the one where of the observer affecting what's observed, so transcending the reality of objectivity, where quantum meets Buddhist and Vedanta philosophy.
Yeah.
And so I said I want to be able to use the word. So I started using it, talking about a selfless soul. And I started saying that that, you know, there are expressions in some sutras where not only there's no soul, jiva, which really better translate jiva than atma, but there's no jiva, but also in those same ones, there's no hand, there's no eye, no ear, no nose, there's no everything, you know, and there's a certain meaning for that. So in other words, when it's no, 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 everything gets included. But in the relative sense, the only thing that's no is atma, used particularly in the sense of the small personality self.
Yeah, yeah. Mini me, I call it.
Yeah, yeah. Me, and I, and mine, yeah. You know. Yeah. And so, therefore, as long as one realizes that the soul is not a fixed barcode of some sort of ultimate separate thing that never changes, if you realize that your identity is always changing, it's a continuum, and it's affected by what you do at the coarser levels of identity, then the soul becomes where your genetic, evolutionary, karmic, genetic stream is carried until you become a Buddha. And that's what carries the imprint of your realizations, your insight, your generosity, or your stinginess, your evil, your confusion, is carried from life to life by that. And that's definitely fits our definition of soul, although not the definition of somebody's idea of a fixed identity soul.
Ram Dass, he was right there with that. The most fun thing, though, he'd be up on that stage and he'd be with you or Sharon or Joseph or Jack or Lama Suridas, whoever, and he would start talking about soul land or something. And then as he said the word soul, he'd sneakily look over at whoever Buddhist was, you know, and got this sly grin, and they would go, it's okay.
Well, yeah.
It was so wonderful.
Well, the thing is that when I said I started doing that, and then I was in Dharamsala and I went to teaching with Dalai Lama, and he just threw out, oh, yeah, we can use soul.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, we can use that. And he didn't go and just very hedging it around the way I just did with all the qualification, but he would have. I had pressed him. So I was thrilled to have that also ratifying that what I was planning, what I was doing there, you know. And that has to do, you see, that in Buddhism, like your Theravada Buddhist person wouldn't even know that. And even some types of Mahayana type would not. Because that really, they don't really unpack the idea of the super subtle mind, and therefore, which is what then can be used to explain the rebirth process. In a technical sort of scientific way, if that's kept esoteric throughout most of Buddhist history, because if that was generally known by people, then a lot of people in Asia of those days who didn't have quantum physics and so on as a popularly known thing, weren't actually already nihilists in large numbers like they are, they would transfer their own rigid identity habit onto a feeling of constriction that they have in their heart chakra. And it would be not easy to help them embrace total openness and total self-surrender that is required to discover Brahma Nirvana or Shunyata Nirvana or whatever you want to call it, you know?
Yeah. Well,
What the Zen people call the great death.
Right.
You know, or the spiritual death where you give it up, you know, completely.
Yeah. Well, this brings us to, I did want to spend a little bit of time on this podcast with you. And this is a good segue. Restriction of the heart chakra. Boy, we are collectively dealing with a big run on that restriction as a result of the fear and chaos and all of it in the big picture. Yeah, give us a little bit of your take on that and all the way to people need some real help.
Sure. Well, this is the Buddha's great scientific discovery, actually. And it mirrors the discovery within the Upanishadic tradition, which then is like the more conservative side of that wave that happened in the mid of the first millennium before the Common Era, based, you know, on Buddha and Mahavira's and these great yogis' discovery of the total openness of the self, and the total openness of the heart, which to understand the whole the knot in the heart chakra has to open, mm-hmm. which normally, and for normal people, only opens at death. Actually, and that is, and it is because of its opening at the normal person's death that the normal person then leaves the body. But these great yogis developed the ability to open that while remaining alive, although they could have left the body, but they still remain connected to that body but not involuntarily connected, but voluntarily connected, because there's some further use of it, of finding, embedding that non-dual total openness in life. So in other words, they become non-dual about death and life. So they're what I like to call them, they're the dying live, mm-hmm. not the living dead, mm-hmm. but the dying live.
Dying live.
The great saint is like that. That's why they can do these miracles, and they have this tremendous detachment and so forth, and et cetera. So I'm saying, at the moment, of course, nobody's saying that everybody on the planet is going to become a Buddha in their own awareness. In a way, they all have a nature of that, but they're not going to necessarily do that in all their awareness. However, if you take the gradient from the really rigidly knotted heart chakra, connected to the very strong egotism and ego grasping of, it's just me, I'm the only one in the world, you know, like, it's only me, you know, I'm the whole thing, in a very tight, closed way, which then also leads that person to be very, very frightened, because then they are scared of everything else, which is not them. And they're surrounded by a not them that is so much bigger than they are, that they're automatically tense and uptight, as we would say.
And polarized all the way.
Yes. So the process of doing that is not like an explosion in your heart, because that would just kill you. It's not like slicing through a Gordian knot in a split second, because that would also remove yours from your own nervous system. It would not be healthy. It's a much more subtle, bit by bit, dismantling of the rigidity of your identity and your ego sense. It's not also a complete destruction of your ego sense, as some people wrongly think. If you're Buddhist or Hindu, you're supposed to have no ego. That's nonsense. You discover that what ego is a conceptual way of organizing the processes of your life, which are this complex thing, and actually keeping them really open and loving and all that, but then being responsible. Then the ego is the narrative of where you then are a loving being, an open being, a selfless being, but you're still there responsibly to help others and so on. Yeah. So there's this gradation. And so, for example, religious fanaticism, sexism, racism, only males are really alive, you know, forget it, you know, type of thing. So sexism, and for the other ones are lesser, you know, and that's I'm a male, you know, and then rigid holding in the chakra of the heart chakra, that sense of identity. Rigid race thing, I'm just even they're so delusory when they say white. My latest is that there are no whites, they're only pinks. All white people are just pink, even usually somewhat blotchy pink, in search of a tan, actually. There's no such white, you know, yeah. But never mind that. But anyway, you know, or even you can have black racism, because we're so superior, and those white pinkies, they can't dance, you know. Mm. And then you can have yellow racism, all those whites and blacks are nothing. And then the reds are hard to find, the native people, and they can be racist too. So in other words, you can, whatever you rigidly wrap your identity around, or even, which all based on the false idea that there is any identity at all, because identity means something that's always the same and never changes. So nothing individual, personal, is always the same and never changes. The universal connectedness to all individuals isn't it? Maybe that's all the same. It never changes, but it's infinite. And so even the good individual who can somehow keep connected, being responsibly living non-dually, but responsible part of a community, which is, you know, sounds ambiguous. It sounds contradictory, but actually it's only ambiguous and requires a tolerance of a high level of tolerance of ambiguity to manage that, which the great saints and the great teachers all had, you know, like where, you know, where like Buddha himself said at the morning of his enlightenment, he said, wow, you know, I know everything now. Totally. And it's so great. You know, Nirvana, guys, here it is, the doorway to Nirvana. But you know what? Unfortunately, although I can make some statements that are in the general area, I can't really explain it to you because you can't understand it just by having a formula about it. You know, you have to, you know, all formulas fall short of this miraculous, brilliant, blissful reality that is the world, but the real world. But I can help you with getting rid of some blocks to your ability to experiencing it because you are it too. And so that's all I can do. I can't really explain it to you. Mm. You know, so that's beautiful ambiguity. It's inexpressible, but I'm going to keep talking because I can give you some negations like anatma or paramatma. Paramatma not being the petty little atma, right?
Yeah.
Those are contradictory. You see those things. So there's two ways of saying it, as a negation or as a transcendence, you know? But they're really the same. So that's the thing. So therefore, this psychology, and that is why meditation directed in that way, in other words, once the meditator has some idea of having looked within and having discovered that the unfindability of a fixed core in there, the only thing that seems fixed is the fact that the masks keep falling off when you really become one pointed toward mindful interiorization. And when people meditate in that way, then the lesser levels of identity, like my identity as a male, my identity as a speaker of English, my identity as an American or a Russian or an Indian, my identity as Jewish, my identity as Goyim, my identity as an Indian, as a Black, all of these things will peel away before the big one comes, which is my identity as alive versus dead, as whatever, you know, and then no identity, and also no identity of no, and also then the final one being my identity of no identity falls off, and I've got to actually be responsible for some sort of participation within this glory of non-duality, whether it's divine or Buddha, or whatever it is. I have to be responsible to my relative being. And then that's where Tantra comes in, is creating the beautiful, loving, divine relative being. You know, either Shaiva Tantra or Buddhist or Vaishnava Tantra or Shakti Tantra, whatever kind. That's actually where it begins, is from that realization of no identity, but that there's no identity of no identity. That would be simply separation, and that would not be the ultimate. So being one and interconnected with it all, there is no identity of non-identity. So therefore, the non-identity fits beautifully with the most loving possible, wonderful Saint Ram Dass identity, sweetly smiling through the tears.
Yeah, and he would, through the pain. You know, and he would. This is an interesting point because we're moving back to the relative, right? We are here in this world. We do need. He would say we need to take action. Taking no action relative to social justice, for instance, means you're taking big action.
That's right.
And he would say, that doesn't mean you have to wait until the moment that you are a living Buddha. We work on ourselves on a day-to-day basis, and yet we take that action. It is not always going to be right action because we carry with us anger. We carry with us projections of how it should be. And this is when we, and certainly when we talk about racism, and we talk about what happened with George Floyd and the outburst that has gone on, and white people perhaps waking up in a way that they haven't woken up you know, talk about awoken. This is still something that I know that Ram Dass talked about, because we found these incredible videos of a thing he did called Reaching Out, which went on television in the late 80s, where he sat around and talked with indigenous people, Latino people, and African-American.
Great, wonderful.
Yeah, yeah. So we're integrating that. We're trying to figure out how we can share it with people and so on. But very much in it is this thing of action, this thing of education, of understanding. We have not sat, we have not lived in the boots of people on the ground who have gotten what Mikad Brooks, who's a wonderful actor and social activist, said to me. At some point, every black child gets told the story. I think he put it another way. But the story is, you now, when you leave this house, you have the potential to be accosted either by white people who hate you or by the police, and here's how to act. They get the whole narrative as, you know, as soon as they can understand anything. We cannot understand this. This is not experiential in any way possible. So the action. So I mean, Bob, you know, we've been doing stuff and trying to educate ourselves and integrate and love, serve, remember, inclusion and diversity and all of it. You know, which everybody is doing now because they're waking up a little bit. But there's a little bit of pushback with the spiritual community. Ram Dass would say it's all one. So all of us matter and so on. It is such, to me, a bypass and an up level, but I'm working on it because I'm sure that's something that I have said myself in some other way, in some other, you know, past.
Right.
And so, yeah, I think that's an important thing for us to recognize in terms of the relative reality that we are in a body and we need to take action, no?
Yes. And I do love, though, and I love I'm very fond of the form of the Kala Chakra Buddha.
Explain that out a little bit, because people don't...
Well, the Wheel of Time, you know, an anciently esoteric form of Buddha, of Unexcelled Yoga Tantra, as it is called, which is considered sort of the most connected to history and to action in time. And his front face of the male one is black, and his right face is red, and his left face is white, and his back face is yellow, and his partner is golden, with her front face yellow, back face green, very dark green, like black green, and then the same red and white on the two sides. She has also four faces, and they're really also considered one being. They're an androgynous being, actually. So when you meditate that form, you are meditating yourself as both sides of a blissfully united couple. It's very far out, neurologically speaking, let's say. But what is really wonderful about it as a hopeful thing, you know, is that there you are, all of these colors, you know, as faces of one being, if you follow. And of course, you know, you could, and actually there are forms where it's a thousand faces with all kinds of pastel interconnected colors. So it's inhabiting, you know, all of these forms and showing their complete ultimate equality, but even relative interconnectedness. So there's no superior one or another. Each one is fitted for different environments. That's all. That's how they got to be the different complexions, you know, because of different environments. So I love that. That's a sort of just a little hint of some sort of very, very advanced level that the yogi and yogini who really decide to become, you know, try to go all the way with it, they can use, you know, they can use that level. And in the meantime, you know, I don't think we should ever say never. In other words, unfortunately, I never had this ability, but not because of any, you know, thing, but just, I just never got a chance. If a white person would go and live in a black country and be of the rare face the rare pink face that is bopping around there. And then one will run into some people who will be annoyed from colonialism or whatever. And one will begin to feel like a kind of outcast and a little bit paranoid. And, you know, we could certainly learn it, you know. And we will be doing that, I believe, in the future as things become more equal. And this, of course, is the whole Trump, Reagan through Trump phenomenon. This came out in the open of the, you know, the white, so-called white pink majority losing its majority status to people of multiple colors, you know. And the big freakout has to do with that, of them not willing to embrace the equality that is in our through line. You know, some people who get too left and too radical, they go like, it's like they get too angry and then they say, oh, it's always been criminal from the beginning. America was built on a genocide and et cetera, et cetera. Well, oh, yes, that's true. But luckily we failed in the genocide, as they always will fail. And the native people are still here. And they are, you know, their saints are compassionate toward us. Their non-saints are annoyed with us. But they're still here, and they will always still be here. And the blacks are here, and there's more of them coming. And the yellows have arrived, and they're going to be in here in numbers, too. You know, it's kind of significant that these white race supremacists who are having a freak out right now because they're losing, because they're so incompetent, are choosing this as a moment to somehow act like it's justified now to attack the Chinese. Sure, of course, we don't like the Communist Party. Nobody likes dictatorships, and that's against our code, right? But meanwhile, our guy wants to be a dictator, a white dictator. Just pathetically self-contradictory and confused, these people. But they're picking that time to attack them, which we mustn't do, actually.
Yeah,
we can criticize their bad business practices and their espionage, and they're robbing copyrights. But the Chinese people helped. They built the railroad. You know, they are part of America from hundreds of years. And they're also going to be part of America and part of the world. The world is a multiracial world.
Yeah.
And our through line of Thomas Jefferson, who never gets credit, because he fell in love with Sally Hemings, and then he fathered children by her, and they don't really honor whoever the Jefferson heirs are. They're not really meeting with the Hemings, I think. Yeah, they will eventually, I'm sure, but they don't have a yearly jamboree bringing in the Hemings, which they will. They should start doing. But point is, he submitted bills into the Virginia legislature before the United States existed twice to liberate slaves, which would failed, of course. And then he couldn't just liberate his own. They'd be captured by other people. And after that. And then he put all are equal, and put that in the Declaration of Independence. And rights of man, droit de l'homme. He was influenced by the French droit de l'homme theories, you know. And then he was ahead of his time. But that through line is a new beginning there of our racists, genociding people. So I don't think we should, I don't accept that we never can understand living in it like you're in an enemy country or in a war zone. It is a horrible thing, of course, and we can understand it. And, you know, we can develop greater empathy. We can meditate to develop empathy. You know, we can do Vulcan mind transmissions with someone willing to share their mind with us. We can. And actually, when you read James Wright, you know, you can feel those feelings. You see, he makes it happen to your mind if you're a sensitive person. And so we shouldn't go extreme. The point is, we'll get there slowly and bit by bit. We won't pretend to be beyond where we are, but we also won't create never nevers. We won't buy the, I don't buy the never nevers.
Yeah. Yeah. So you talk about through line, and boy, all I can think about, of course, the through line through Dr. King, but most presently for me is John Lewis. Of course, he just passed, and I did a podcast in honor of him with a friend of mine, Danny Goldberg.
Good for you.
Yeah,
good for you.
Who was just so knowledgeable and of the history and of the civil rights movement. But when the more I dug into it, Bob, talk about you mentioned that Native Americans, their saints, so-called saints, they look, you know, that are still compassionate towards us.
Yeah,
and you look at this man was nothing but a saint, John Lewis. Nothing. Sure. Fearless and full of love. It gave more hope to me than anything that I've experienced in a long time in this regard. So
that's really great. I know I really love the guy, and he wouldn't go to the inauguration.
Yeah,
I admire that. Mm.
You know, and when he went to Obama got inaugurated, he was there, and he went up to he had tears in his eyes when he went up to embrace Obama, and Obama turned to him and said, "John, you did this."
That's nice.
Isn't that? You did this.
Yeah, Jesse Jackson was also weeping.
Yeah, yeah, you know? No, absolutely. Well, many of us were at that time. Well, exactly. We're at the end of our time here, Bob. I want to thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. By the way, everybody out there who's listening, we are going to have this virtual retreat at the end of August, August 28th through 30th, with Krishna Das, with Bob, and with Annie Lamott. Annie Lamott, your guru is coming back. Remember that whole thing.
Do we have another minute? Can I take one tiny little bit?
Absolutely.
Add a meditation, because of something people can do.
Absolutely.
In the time of
Please.
The thing, and that is that you meditate. And what you do is you practice this, what's known as mother recognition. And, you know, if you're out in the street and you're not black, but even if you are black too, but you sit there and you can now and then meditate mother recognition. And what that means is, although you may not yet have a belief that you had many previous lives, in fact, beginninglessly infinite previous lives, just pretend that for the moment, you've been everywhere and done everything in many infinite past lives. So what it might feel like, simulate that feeling. And the minute you do, you will also realize that you could simulate the feeling that everybody else has been everywhere in infinite previously past lives. And then you can just sort of intellectually at first say to yourself, well, then everybody else has at some time or another been my mother in some previous life. In it, not only all is in human form, in different animals, different mammals. Sometimes maybe she just laid me as an egg, depending on what kind of animal she was. But they've all been my mother. And actually, everyone in the infinite past, they've all been my human mother. So just meditate that, because that's where you mirror your first person you mirror and mirrors you as your mother, right? And you just, by meditating that, and then thinking of, oh, I hate that person, that face of the, I see on TV, the mean, nasty blue meanies who are beating me up and throwing tear gas and sprays, pepper spraying me. But actually, in a previous life, they were my mother. They just don't know it. My fellow members of other races here with me were my mothers in previous life. We were in their race. They were in my race. It was all interwoven like that. And so just now and then meditate the mother recognition meditation. And try to see the motherly expression that always somewhere is some possibility in them, even the meanest person when they look at someone they love. And then realize that is the potential in that face, even if you're angry with that face at the moment. So that's called the first step of developing what they call universal compassion. But the first step is to, in other words, find a sense of kinship with all beings. The Lakota have this, in their heat lodge, sweat lodge ceremony, where they say, Oyatsuke Miyasun, which means all beings are my relatives. So it's that meditation. Mm. Even you could maybe look that up in Blame Deer Speak. Yeah. Oyatsuke Miyasun.
And this is beyond race, this is beyond color, because everybody has a mother, correct?
Exactly.
I do want to say one other thing, though.
Yes, please.
And that's Bob has headed up Tibet House in New York for a long time, and we're going to put a link there to Tibet House, and they could Tibet House.
Oh, thank you, Tibet
to
House.
Get a little bit of help. Anybody who's willing to help, keep Tibet House going, and they put on fantastic programs. The way that they support His Holiness and the Tibetan people is phenomenal.
It's another genocide going on against them over there, and so any bit of their keeping their culture alive, which is Tibet House's role, we're not making political activism, but cultural. It's really helpful. I've even shamelessly requested a birthday present on Facebook.
My birthday,
August 3rd. So $5, it doesn't matter, $10, $3, Bernie Sanders style, any little bit as a they can put in the birthday kitty, and it'll be matched because it's what we have, a matching grant from some generous person and anonymous. But, you know, it's this time when we're trying to do that to keep our staff and our programs alive.
Yeah.
During this time of total shutdown, you know, we've been. So thank you so much for mentioning that.
Yeah, and just this is important too. Is it a nonprofit? I think it
is. Yes, yes, of course.
So anybody donating, it's tax deductible.
That's right, tibethouse.us.
Yeah, okay, that's great. Everybody should know that. Again, thank you so much, everybody. The links are all going to be in there. And
thank you.
You can find out more about Tibet House, more about Bob. We've mentioned the David Bohm movie and whatever and whatever else. And again, you can the end of the month of August on the 28th, Bob will be there. Annie Lamott, Krishna Das, myself, Duncan Trussell.
All right.
Do you know Valerie Kaur? Do you know who that is, Bob?
No, I don't.
You make a point at picking up her book, See No Stranger. Fantastic.
Okay.
Yep, fantastic.
Valerie, well, how do you spell the last name? Kaur?
K-A-U-R. Valerie Kaur. She's a Sikh
person. Okay. Oh, wonderful. I love Guru Nanak.
Yes.
So great.
All right, everybody. Guru we'll Nanak. See you next week on Mind Rolling. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com. Love y'all.
Thank you. Thank you, Raghu. Love you. Love you, Raghu. Thank you so much. All the best.